This is an Alien UFO Podcast Classic episode, and I'm your host Simon Bowne. There are a number of UFO episodes that I released on the podcast a few years ago, and they're full of great information, and I thought it would be a good idea to share them for listeners who may have missed them the first time around. This week I'm talking to Dr. Robert Farrell about his book, The Science Behind Alien Encounters. Dr. Farrell has lectured many times at universities, science centres, MUFON meetings, bookstores, clubs, and senior centres around the country, and has appeared on numerous TV and radio shows, including Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. Hi there, Bob. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So your book is called The Science Behind Alien Encounters. And so when it's talking about science, what is your background?
I worked as an engineer for about 20 years in industry, basically. And my last 5 years, I was a vice president of engineering. And the company manufactured plastics equipment, you know, injection molding machines, things like that. So I taught at Penn State University for 15 years. Toward the end, I started attending UFO conferences. And that's how I really started doing more of the deep research. So I've been doing that for probably 30 years. But the problem was that I saw was at every conference, the big issue was, well, when is there going to be disclosure? My feeling was you're not going to get disclosure until the voters ask for it. When I retired and I had this knowledge that I wanted to share about UFOs, I started writing. But I decided that in order to get the voters interested in the topic, because, you know, starting with like 1953, the government did everything they could to make people look like they're crazy if they reported UFOs. So, and they were successful at doing that. But so I thought, well, the only way I'm going to convince the voters that this is the reality is to give out the information in the form of science fiction. So when they read the science fiction, they accidentally receive a lot of information because what comes out of the dialogue is well researched. So that's how I got into the science fiction part of it. And that was what I first started writing. And also when I retired, I started lecturing. And the title of my lecture was The Science Behind Alien Encounters, which is what the book is. And I started lecturing in 2004. And after a couple of years, it was so well received because people seemed to be hungry for the information. So I decided to cast it into a book. And the book you have read is the second edition. So it's an expanded version over to what I started with. But I don't know, that kind of gives you a summary, I guess, where I am.
You say in the book that you stay away from parallel universes, dimensions, wormholes, time travel. Why is it you're avoiding that stuff?
Yes, because my feeling was this UFO stuff is like magic to a lot of people. They don't, first of all, have been trained not to believe it. And they can say, well, there's no way anything could do these amazing things. And so I felt I had to take a nuts and bolts approach and do it scientifically, basically based on science that the average person would have when they graduated high school. And I avoided other, you know, like fifth dimensions and wormholes and all those things, because that just is one more level that you got to overcome. And so if I could explain things in a very simple nuts and bolts fashion and show evidence, I thought, okay, there's a chance that they're going to believe, but yeah, they could be for real. And that way, my whole goal, don't ask me why I'm doing this, because when I retired from Penn State, I had different idea what retirement would be, but turns out I'm motivated now to try and, you might say, educate the public about this so that when the disclosure comes, it won't be a sudden shock. They'll be ready for it. And that's what I'm trying to do with my lectures and my books.
And you talk about how it was simple logic that led you to the conviction that extraterrestrial life exists. So what was the bits and pieces that came to you that you could use your logic to decide that?
Well, first of all, anybody looks up into the sky at night has to believe that there's got to be other life out there. So that was kind of a given, that there's intelligent life out there. And then in regards to the UFOs and what they could do, there was only one hypothesis in my mind that could satisfy the data. And when I say the data, when I was in industry, I would get involved in failure analysis sometimes. And so I found, well, you lay out all the information that you can gather on a failure, and the answer stares at you. So I thought, okay, I don't have access to any broken UFOs to you know, scientifically say, well, this. What I have access to is reports by credible witnesses, you know, like astronauts and people who run radar equipment, things like that, pilots. So there's a lot of credible witness reports out there, if you read them, and they describe what they saw. And so you like list all the things that they have seen, these things do. And in my mind, the only possible scenario is that they are propelling their craft with gravitational field propulsion. Because I can explain how a lot of the things that people report is explained by a gravitational field propulsion. Excuse me. In my lecture and in the book that you have read, I can also explain how they cloak themselves. There's a couple of ways they could do that, because people have seen them. They see them and then they don't see it. It's like they just suddenly disappear. And a lot of evidence that they have the ability to cloak themselves. And there's a lot of evidence in my mind that shows that they're not only using a gravitational field, but it's a negative field. And that's a hard sell, because we don't have an experience normally in a negative field. But I talk about experiments that have been done either through serendipity. They automatically, they just produced a field, and they weren't sure if it was negative or positive. But when you analyze the data, it was probably a negative field. We talk about photographs of UFOs taking off. And there's a cloud of dust that is kicked up when they take off. And you can see underneath the craft, the dust, that there's clear areas where there's no dust. And I interpret that as meaning that it's being expelled by the negative field that is actually lifting the craft up. And then there's the story once about a car in Illinois. Excuse me a second. A car in Illinois where actually a UFO ran into it, and it was cloaked, and it was being protected by a negative field that puts around itself as a shield, might say. And so the next morning, because the driver didn't see anything other than suddenly the car lurched to the right. And next day you look at the car, and the left side is all caved in. There's no scratches or blood or anything like that. Like maybe an animal hit them. But had a UFO hit them with this negative field, it would have, you know, pushed in the side of the car. And so the question is, you know, what happened? Why did the driver do that? In my lecture, I joke, well, maybe the driver of the UFO was texting. But who knows?
In the book, there's a thing you talk about. There's a man who exited his car and observed a flying saucer about 30 feet overhead. And when it accelerated upwards, something happened.
Pushed him down. That's right. So, like I say, this is all data. You lay it out there, and there's data. I'm trying to think of other good. Well, freezing of ponds, and I can explain that, because there have been instances where people come upon a shallow pond, and there's evidence that a UFO had just left there, had been hovering over that pond, and even though it might be cold out, it wasn't freezing weather, but yet the pond was frozen. And so how can that be? Well, again, that's evidence for a negative gravity underneath the craft, because it would be expelling the air, creating a low pressure, if you will, over the surface of the pond. And of course, under a low pressure, the water evaporates faster. And in evaporation, the molecules are taking energy away as they leave. And so what's left behind gets colder and colder and colder, and finally it freezes. And that's basically the refrigeration process. Cooling towers use that same process to cool. So, but that to me is another evidence that, that it's a negative field.
This kind of reminds me of Bob Lazar and the work he talked about doing at, was it Area 51, where it was some kind of gravity generator that would produce a gravity wave that was inverse to the Earth's gravity wave. Have you read all that stuff?
Yes. In fact, first of all, I have to say when Lazar first came forward, basically years ago, I was a skeptic, especially when he said, well, if they use element 115. Well, of course, that hadn't even been discovered yet, so that was a strike against him. But eventually, we actually discovered the element 115. And the thing that was interesting to me is in an interview that I saw him do, he mentioned that he would try, his partner was working on this project with him. They had this generator, they called it, the size of a basketball, that was generating this gravitational field. And his partner said, try and touch it. So he went to touch it, and as he got closer, it was like a magnet, you know, two opposing north fields. They oppose each other, and that's the way his hand felt. He says as it got closer, it was harder and harder. He said, so it was a repulsive field that was coming out of that generator. Again, more evidence for a negative field.
It makes me wonder about Travis Walton's experience, because I'm sure you know that he was close to a craft and something hit him and knocked him to the ground, and his crew thought he'd been killed. And I'm wondering if some kind of field that you're talking about accidentally hit him.
Oh, sure. He claims, you're talking about fire in the sky, basically.
Yeah.
Travis Walton. Yeah. Yeah, I've actually met him several times. He's just, you know, a straight shooter, basically. And he's on the same mission I am. He goes around lecturing about his experience, trying to convince people that this is a reality. But yeah, he felt, now he feels that they would actually try to, they brought him aboard the craft because they thought they had damaged him. And when he was accidentally hit by this beam. And he also had said, at least in his lectures, that he regrets the movie that came out at first because it didn't accurately portray his situation. And but he had signed the rights away, you know, to the movie company, and so he had no way to control it. But subsequently, he's now been going around and trying to set the record straight, and he doesn't feel that they meant him harm, but they were just like, I think, and this is true of most abductions, where someone is picked up in the field someplace or driving their car, who knows, taken aboard a craft and examined, and then let go. It's kind of the same thing we might do. We're exploring strange country or a jungle, and you could, you know, pick up an animal to study it, tag it maybe. So my belief is they're not malevolent. I think they might be watching over us, because we're getting pretty close to the point of destroying the planet. And I'm hoping they step in pretty soon. But that was Travis's experience.
Yeah, I was talking to, you know, Mike Cleland recently, and he said there seems to be a message that ETs transfer during abductions, where they're saying your technology has far outstripped your spirituality, and this is dangerous.
That's exactly right, and that's why I feel too, that these beings, not only are they far ahead of us technologically, but also spiritually. Another reason why I don't fear them, I don't think they mean us harm. And I think, in fact, if you somehow I managed to get into books written by Zachariah Sitchin, the late Zachariah, if you haven't read them, I would encourage at least reading The 12th Planet, because he led me into a deeper area of this whole field of ufology and wanting to know more about the ancient cases. And of course, Sitchin was curious to know about the origin of his religion. He was Jewish, and he did a lot of research, written in a number of languages. But The 12th Planet was the first book he wrote of his Earth Chronicles. And so his interpretation of what he gathered from actually reading cuneiform and studying mythology was that the Sumerians believed that there was another planet that orbited the Earth, and they called it Nibiru, and the Anunnaki came from the planet Nibiru. Now, at the time Sitchin wrote that, his book came out in 1976. If you went up and talked to an astronomer and said, what do you think about these rogue planets? And he would say, what? Because they didn't really know anything about rogue planets. And so, but Sitchin put it out there that the Sumerians knew about this rogue planet. Today now, using gravitational lensing techniques, because you can't see a rogue planet, it's dark in the sense that it's not radiating a lot of energy, so they'd be hard to find. But by using techniques of gravitational lensing, they can now detect these bodies. And in fact, some think that there may be, for every planet in this in our galaxy, for every four planets, I should say, Jupiter-sized planets, there may be a rogue planet wandering around. And it was either thrown off from a solar system, or it could have formed on its own, just like the sun did. But its mass was too small to start any fusion. So just a dead planet, but it might have moons. And in fact, Nibiru supposedly had 11 moons. And the interesting thing is, according to the mythology, this Nibiru, in one of its orbits, and its orbit took 3,600 years to complete. And the closest approach, as near as I can tell, is where the asteroid belt is. And so according to the Sumerian mythology, this Nibiru encountered a planet called Tiamat. It was in orbit where the asteroid belt is, and one of its moons crashed into it and damaged it, and another moon eventually split it up into what we call the asteroid belt, and the other half was the large chunk that had a large moon that ended up down where Earth is today. Well, that actually explains some things that astronomers are wrestling with right now, because where our Earth is, it should not be, it should not have as much water as it has, because it's so close to the sun. And so how do you explain that? And they've tried different theories and none of them work. But they did do some research on the ratio of hydrogen and deuterium. It's a certain ratio that occurs on the water on the planet Earth. And when we brought stuff back from the moon, guess what? It matched what's on the Earth. When they sampled water from an asteroid, the asteroid came from deep space beyond Neptune, the ratio was three times higher than on Earth. If they sampled the water that was in a meteorite that they knew had come from the asteroid belt, guess what? It matched the Earth. So that data points to the fact that maybe the Earth actually did originate out there. The other thing is, the further you go out away from the sun, you find more water. Ceres, which is the largest asteroid, has 25% water ice. And if you go out even further, the moons of Jupiter and Saturn are, I don't know, 50% water ice. I don't remember what it is. But the point is, the further out you go, more water you get. So there's all that evidence that says that what Sitchin had gleaned out of his studies of the Sumerian culture is probably correct. And he also said that the Sumerians believed that these Anunnaki created the first human. And he even went to the extent of saying they did that in South Africa about 200,000 or 300,000 years ago. And they were in the process of mining gold when they first came here. And so I think they created these humans to be slaves to help mine gold or do whatever they needed to get done. And again, he put that in his book that he wrote in 1976. And it's 10 years later in 1986 that some researchers out of University of California had been studying the mitochondrial DNA from placenta, that they had 147 different placentas from around the world. And they came to a conclusion independently that the first human appeared in South Africa about 200,000 or 300,000 years ago. And guess what? It was right in an area where there are known thousands of ancient gold mines. Well, hundreds anyway, hundreds of ancient gold mines. So everything Sitchin says fits together. And another thing he talked about was the Noah's flood, which was a Sumerian event. And that got me looking into that aspect, which is why I ended up writing the science behind Noah's flood. And in that book, I dedicated a whole chapter of actually applying science that has occurred since 1976, applying it to show that everything Pidgeon had said is true. And so that's, you know, the when you get into this ufology thing, you kind of end up going in all kinds of directions, because you've got to find out about our ancient history and how aliens may have impacted that. And it's a fascinating field, I have to say.
So if that planet Nibiru is currently out there and it's in a really long orbit, was it 3,600 years? When could we expect it to come back and the scientists can spot it?
That is a good question. I did a quick calculation, and in its farthest approach, it's I think I figured it was like 10 times further out than Pluto, and it spends almost all of its time beyond the orbit of Jupiter. And in fact, I calculated that probably only maybe 5 years or 10 years of that 3,600 years would it be visible inside the orbit of Jupiter. But it would probably be fairly bright, be like a bright star at night when it came. And again, Sitchin had determined that it would appear coming from the southern hemisphere. And so I tie that in with a later discovery that I'm not even sure if Zachariah Sitchin had a chance to actually go there, but Göbekli Tepe, which is, it's supposedly the oldest monolithic structure on the planet Earth. And the archaeologist who's passed away, Dr. Schmidt, had spent like 20 years digging, and he'd uncovered four of the rings, which were really, and he was convinced that they were probably religious sites. But he dated them on the surface to be about 12,000 years ago. And he dated, he said, with ground penetrating radar, there were more further down for a total of 20. And he said some of those might be 14,000 years old. So in the science behind Noah's flood, I dated the Noah's flood to be about 14,500 years ago. And the result, and again, I even got into this subject because Sitchin said that he believed that Noah's flood was caused by a mega tsunami created by the collapsing ice sheets in Antarctica. But he thought that it was the periodic arrival of Nibiru that created a gravitational field, you know, that was large enough to cause instability and cause these huge ice sheets to crash into the Indian Ocean and create the tsunami. So that led me into researching all that stuff. And so I think he was off maybe by 1,000 or 2,000 years. But I think he's right in that, because if you look at the sea level, there are maps of sea level going back 20,000 years. And 20 to 15,000 years ago, sea level was 370 feet lower than it is today. And if you look at the soundings of Persian Gulf, the deepest part is only like 150 feet deep, which means that it was a lake. Back 15,000 years ago, it was a lake. And guess what? Fed by four rivers, just like the Bible said. And it was streaming down probably through a gully or a ravine into the Indian Ocean. And then the mega tsunami, which would have been created by this 8-mile-high ice sheets, I mean, huge ice sheets along the eastern edge of Antarctica, which faces directly toward the Straits of Hormuz. And so when that starts calving, the energy that it releases would be horrendous. And at that period in time, about 14,500 years ago, there was the Bolling-Alerod warming spell where the planet was warming up. And so that would have caused, again, first of all, the ice sheets floating on the water to break up. And once those ice sheets leave, of course, when they melt, break up, they would change the sea level. But when they break away from the coast, they no longer prevent the huge glaciers from marching forward and carried into the sea. And so I think it wasn't Nibiru that caused this disaster, you might say, but rather just the fact that the warming trend as we came out of the ice age. And the interesting thing, if you take that date and say, okay, Noah, you know, got involved in this flood, and it was a big flood, about 14,000 years ago, and he would have been carried northwest between the Tigris and Euphrates River. And in fact, the mythology says that Noah, actually it was called Upnapishtim in the mythology, he resided at the headwaters of the Euphrates River. Guess where that is? That's in Turkey, just over the border from, might be Syria. But anyway, it's in southeastern Turkey. And that's where Göbekli Tepe is. And there's a town or a site called Novella Kore, which is at the headwaters of the Euphrates. There's now a dam there, created a lake, but before they finished the dam, archaeologists went in to explore the ruins that were at Corina Valley. And the structure, architecture of the structure strongly resembled what appeared in Göbekli Tepe. And the interesting thing is, in both cases, both at Novella Kore and also in all the rings at Göbekli Tepe, that there's rings of stones. There's like a dozen stones erected that represent, I think, the deities, because the Sumerians had 12 deities, and that's what reason there's 12 zodiac symbols, sky. But the two main gods are tall columns in the center, with anthropomorphic images on the front, like hands coming around and on their waist. And they always are facing toward the south, each one at a different angle, because if they're looking for Nibiru, which I think they were, I mean, that would have been a major event when Nibiru appears. And so these two gods are facing in that direction, overlooking the Valley of Haran. So it all ties together, you know, and it has to.
So with the modern era of UFOs, you say in the book you believe that the first atomic bomb tests were what got ETs interested in us.
Yeah, I think so. As a matter of fact, if you go back to 1947, for instance, Arnold, who was the first pilot to kind of report seeing, he didn't call them flying saucers, but the press called them flying saucers. That was in June of 1947. And that same month, Einstein and Robert Oppenheimer, two famous people who happened to be employed, you might say, at Princeton University, they had this meeting, I guess it was a secret meeting, to discuss the celestial visitors, they called them. And it was interesting that it seemed like the biggest concern was what property rights they might have, because maybe they already been on the moon, so they own the moon, you know, that kind of thing. But they referred to them as celestial visitors, and they said, well, maybe our nuclear testing, or, you know, firing off nuclear bombs got their attention. That was what they thought. And they actually did that before Roswell, because Roswell was in July. So it was a busy year in 1947.
There's this idea you have that perhaps it's technology that we were using that caused the UFOs to crash. And you talk about the Kingman crash in 1953 that may have been caused by a nuclear test.
Yes. Now, there is another scenario that says that wasn't caused by a nuclear test, but then they thought that was actually caused by radar, that high-powered radar had disabled their craft. And if indeed they are creating their gravitational field by manipulating the electromagnetic field, which is what I believe, and Einstein would have said that, then, yeah, they'd be susceptible to a high-powered beams like from radar. But I did some research, and in 1953, in that area, they weren't quite yet to that point in radar development. They eventually did build a radar site there, but it was after the fact. And I happen to remember that particular event in May of 1953. I was in high school, and I knew I was almost late for school because it was going to be televised. They're going to televise this atomic blast, and you know, I wanted to stay home and watch it. So I almost was late for school. But they wanted the public to see that the atomic attack would be survivable. I think that was the whole image why they televised it. But I could imagine, because of the interest they had, that UFOs had, in what we were doing, that they would have had scout ships stationed in that area to monitor these tests. And it so happens that the previous test, which was in the same area, and it was, I think, also a tower test, occurred a little bit earlier in time, like maybe an hour before the Dirty Harry test, which is what they called it. And so I'm imagining you're aboard this UFO, and you know that they do this testing, and hey, it's past time. What's going on? So maybe they moved in closer to analyze it because they could use the infrared beams and stuff and actually probably see what's going wrong. And they got too close, and the bomb went off. And I don't care what kind of UFO you have, it probably wouldn't be couldn't survive in the middle of an atomic blast. And so I think it was wounded or damaged. And so they were able, though, to control the craft long enough to get a couple hundred miles away before they landed in Arizona. Yeah, they made it to Arizona. And that's where the 1953 craft was found. And so, again, I say the cause of the crash was the fact that it was damaged while it was observing Dirty Harry.
And there may be other crashes that happened over time. You know, obviously, Roswell's famous. But one of the questions that you ask in the book is, how can UFOs crash if their technology is so good? Because they're presumably much more advanced than us.
Yeah. Well, of course, if they're too close to an atomic bomb when it goes off, that'd probably be one reason. But also, because I would discuss this with the late Stanton Friedman, who's kind of an icon, he was. But he, of course, was a nuclear engineer in his training. And it was his theory that these were crashing because of the radar, high-powered radar that was being developed during World War II. And it so happens that, most of the places where they were crashing was where they had high-powered radar. And again, that probably would have disrupted their propulsion system and they could have crashed.
So you also go into the religious implications of this stuff, and you talk about Monsignor Corrado Balducci. Could you tell us about him, what he said?
Yeah, his background, I think he had been an exorcist out of the Vatican. And but he had, for several years, two or three, maybe 4 years, been very outspoken about ETs. And UFOs, and I guess have been on Rome Radio a number of times. So he was a logical choice to have as the keynote speaker at the 2005 X conference that was held just outside of Washington, D.C. And I'll finish that story in a minute, but I just want to say of all the religions, I think the Catholic religion is the most proactive in trying to address this problem. Because I think that was the mission that he had been assigned, maybe, is to get out there and kind of test the waters, you know, start talking about this stuff and get people prepared for the fact that, yes, there might be other beings out there. And in fact, that's what he said at the X conference in his keynote speech. He said that there's so much evidence now that we can't deny that there might be other intelligent beings like humans. And so that was kind of his bottom line, that how can we deny that? And how can we put limits on God's creativity? And then later on, 2008, I think it was, the head of the Vatican Observatory made a similar statement that how can we, and that's the bottom line. That's what I tell people, you know, if I encounter someone who believes deeply in the Bible and says, well, there can't be anything beyond earth. And then I say, well, how can you put a limit on God's creation? Because that's what they'd be doing.
Yeah, it's a good question. If God is, you know, this omnipotent being with who created this universe that is so big, why would there just be life on this one tiny planet and this one galaxy?
That's right. And in fact, I write science fiction, but I try to make the dialogue basically me speaking based on the research that I had done. And in the second book of Alien Log, I have Alien Log as the first, Alien Log number two, The New World Order. And I think it was in that book that there was a discussion between a human and the alien. And the alien was explaining how they had, the scientists had discovered 500,000 years ago that there was a creator of the universe. And I had read a doctoral thesis that a student of theology had written. And he went through a mathematical solution to prove that it was impossible for our universe to come about accidentally. It had to have intelligent design behind it. And so the aliens believe that, at least in my book, you know, that they believe in a higher being, I guess you could say. And you know, I don't know if you want to call that religion or not, but they believe in a creator.
Yeah, I was talking to a guest on the podcast recently who said that there were some ETs that some abductees talked about, and these ETs believed in some kind of higher power or higher source.
Yeah, even in cases where people have had near-death experiences, they talk about approaching a light and being overwhelmed by the amount of love that they felt, to the extent that they almost didn't want to come back. And that's the way I feel about it. You know, I'm not wanting to die now because life's too interesting. There's a lot more I want to see and do, but I'm not afraid of dying. And I believe no matter what, I'll be welcomed into heaven, because I believe that God is a God of unconditional love. There's no conditions required to get into heaven. Even people say, well, do you mean even Hitler got in? I don't know. If it's unconditional, it's unconditional. That's what I believe.
So if we change the subject now quite a lot, I think.
Yes, we have.
What's your view on crop circles? Because you do write a little bit about them in the book, and there's a lot of people who just feel they're just a hoax.
Yes, well, you know, Dave and Doug Corley, you know, in what, 1991 was it, that they went on public television and said, well, we're the ones that are making these crop circles. And they took the camera crew out into the field, and armed with some boards and string, they made a crop circle. And so right away, people thought, well, okay, they're all hoax. But if they're the ones that made them, they were really busy, because there were like thousands of made. But I believe that these are signs that maybe our intelligence is being tested. Because right now, if they would land on planet Earth, I mean, overtly, not covertly, to have a discussion with us, what could we bring to the table to talk about? I think we're pretty dumb relative to them. So maybe they're measuring our intelligence with these crop circles, because a lot of them have information embedded in them and new stuff, you know, I guess. But the way they are created, they cannot really be created, at least not as fast, by people. They have certain things about them that make them unique. For one thing, Dr. Levengood, I'm not sure if he's still alive, but he got involved. He was a plant biologist and well-known. And so somehow he got involved in this crop circle thing, and they sent samples to him, both samples out of the crop circle and samples nearby, you know, the control samples. And one of the things he had observed with the nodes and the plants had evidence of being heated very rapidly, like if they were inside a radar oven. And there were expulsion cavities where the steam would have blown out. And the cavities were, those nodes were elongated. Also, the stems weren't broken. They were bent over in a true, and I have not been in a crop circle, but I always wanted to go. Maybe I'll come and visit you sometime and we can turn. But also supposedly in the soil, there's a high concentration of nickel in there. And people who have gone into these say that it's an unusual experience. Either they get nauseous maybe, or it's almost like a religious experience for them. So it has an effect on their minds. They claim that birds won't fly over them. I don't know if that's true, but they are very unusual. I don't think they're man-made, and I think the designs are created in a way to give us information or test our intelligence. And in Alien Log, the first book, one of the main characters, Corey is his name, is an astrophysicist, and he's asked about this. And it was his feeling that that UFOs were creating them, and they were doing this with radiation, like microwave. And but in the second book, he's having a chat with an alien, and he's made to think about, well, maybe there's another way to do the same thing. How about ultrasound? And so now maybe Corey's now thinking, aha, ultrasound perhaps could have been used. There was a scientist, he was actually a doctor, I think, a medical doctor, but also a scientist in his mind, who was studying ultrasound. And he could create designs by vibrating iron filings or just any kind of powder, and create all kinds of designs based on the frequency and amplitude of these vibrations. So I could visualize that the craft beaming down ultrasound, they could make the crops dance, if you would, and behave, and also would provide perhaps enough energy to cause the expulsion cavities. But I don't really know, other than that, how they do it, and I don't think anybody does for sure. But I haven't really been there yet to see one.
One of the skeptical arguments against UFOs is to say the space is so big, there's no way that ETs could get from another star to us. So in your book, you talk about this. How do ETs travel great distances? And what's your idea here?
Yeah. Well, first of all, assuming Einstein's correct, and I think that's been proven correct, that as you approach very high velocities approaching the speed of light, that the clocks run slower aboard that craft. And so if you can travel, in fact, I show a graph. I don't know if I did in the book or not, but in my lectures, I have a graph that shows taking off and accelerating at 100 Gs, accelerate, because they can accelerate at 100 Gs easily, 1,000 Gs if you want, but 100. They've been clocked at 100. And over a period of about a month, if your craft would be, from the Earth point of view, 40 light years away. And but your calendar aboard craft would have said you've only been gone a month. And so now if you turned around and came back, going back down that curve, you'd be back. Your whole trip would have taken you 2 months, as far as you're concerned. But when you open the door and climb out of the craft, the planet you're standing on has aged 80 years. So you basically did time travel. But the point being here is that if you can travel at those very high velocities, you can travel long distances. Just don't plan to go back home again, that kind of thing. And I was thinking about that when I wrote Alien Log, about because they had to come from long distances, and I knew that they would have time dilation to help them. But when they wanted to go back home, everybody they knew would be dead maybe. And so I said, well, maybe what they do is they build a gigantic ship, and the whole city, or everybody, say, well, okay, let's all go on safari. Because what else would you do if you had all the technology, all the energy you need, all the food you need, all the shelter you need, and you've seen every movie that you've ever seen, could possibly be seen? What are you going to do for excitement? You go on safari. And you get the whole town together, and you plan, we're never coming back. Well, we are coming back, but when we come back, it'll be a different town. And so it's not an issue. You just go and you explore. So that's how they can go the great distances. But it has to be a different mindset. The other possibility is, because I think they can live about as long as they want, the time has a different meaning to them, even when they're on Earth here. They could take on a 1,000-year project without a problem. On the other hand, we have this sense of urgency. You know, we've got to get everything done within 70 or 80 years because we're going to die. And we have that sense of urgency of getting things done. If you lived as long as you wanted, you'd take a more leisurely approach and say, well, let's explore this. Let's meet every 100 years and see what the progress is, that kind of thing. It's a whole different idea. You know, it's a different perspective of time. So, and traveling the distances, again, requires a different perspective on time.
And so they would be able to move at great speed because they're using the gravitational field propulsion. And I think you also talk about how they can do these 100G accelerations and right angle turns because they've got that kind of propulsion.
Yes, yes. My lecture, and I probably did in the book too, the thought experiment. And I have a picture of E2 rocket sitting there, and I have a volunteer in the audience agree to go in the nose cone and let me light the match and set them off. And they have a communicating device, and I do too, so we can chat back and forth. So I light the fuse, and off they go, the fuse, and they're going along, and I ask them, you know, what's happening, and they report, well, they're being held in their couch, and the G meter says 4 Gs. And I said, oh, okay. All of a sudden, I noticed the flames sputtering out, and now they're coasting. I said, well, what's happening now? They say, well, I'm tending to float out of my couch. The G meter says 0. And I'm watching. Now it's starting to fall back to Earth. And I say, well, so what's changed? Anything? Oh, no, nothing's changed. I'm still trying to keep my couch because the G meter still says 0. But then I say, you know, you're actually accelerating at 1G toward the Earth, but you don't feel it. You're free falling. I said, if we did this experiment on Jupiter, you'd be accelerating at 40 Gs, but yet you would have no sensation about it. There's no sensation of acceleration that you're accelerating. If you are propelled by a gravitational field, that's one of the beauties. The other thing about a gravitational field or any field propulsion, you don't have to carry this gigantic amount of fuel with you, which you got to throw out the back in order to create thrust. So you can go long distances. It doesn't really matter. And the really interesting part about this whole UFO thing, as far as research that's been done in the laboratory and also through serendipity, and not only is it possible to create a gravitational field, but some of the devices that have been built to create gravitational fields are actually what's called over-unity machines. What that means is you get more power out than you put in. And of course, anybody who studied thermodynamics would say that's impossible because it violates, I think, the second law of thermodynamics. Well, guess what? They do. And there's something called free energy that physicists are talking about now, and it has to do with quantum fluctuations. There's actually what we think is a zero level is not the zero. That's a low. You can go lower and extract energy out of this free energy. And that appears to be what's happening in almost all of the experiments that are being done. By the way, as far as this element 115, as far as I know, I can't remember his name now, but he's the only one that indicates it was being used at Area 51, because all the experiments that I've read about, they didn't have element 15 at their disposal. They didn't need it. And they were able to create a gravitational field.
So when they want to do a right angle turn, if they can control G forces, that's not going to affect you, is it?
Right. They just point vector the field in that direction. They probably have multiple fields around them. If I were them, I would have a more of a negative field pushing me along behind me, pushing me. And I'd also have a negative field in front of me that's of a lesser extent, but it's reaching out and telling everything to get out of the way. It's my shield, basically. And in fact, that's how UFOs can travel 3,000 or 4,000 miles an hour through our atmosphere without having any shockwave, because you have another means of communicating with the molecules ahead of you to get out of the way. Right now, our pilots have a limit. There's something called the speed of sound. And so as the craft, as aircraft get faster and faster, there's pressure build up in front of the craft. And that pressure kind of sends a signal out ahead of the molecules to get away, get away. And but once you reach the speed of sound, that message can't go in front of you. And these things crash into you and create a shockwave. But if you could warn them some other way, like even electric fields, I think they've even tried electric fields, but certainly a negative gravity field, which can reach out way ahead of you and start getting things cleared away for you. And that's how you can go underwater too. If you've got a negative field around you, you can just, doesn't matter whether you're in air or you drop into the water, you can go underwater and it, again, moves the water out of the way, and you don't have a problem with that.
So you have a chapter called What Are the ETs Up To? So what are your theories there?
Well, I really believe they're watching over us, because I believe Sitchin was probably onto something that at least one species may have been here and they created this. And again, you know, like I told you, they live a long, long time. So this whole evolution of the human species may just be an experiment they're watching. But they also, I think, are probably concerned with what we're doing to this planet. David Attenborough produced a film on Netflix called, I think, Our Planet. And he's 93 at the time, and he's talking about just in his lifetime, all the damage humans have done to Earth. And so as far as we wiped out like 6% of the wild species on the planet. You know, we're burning tropical rainforests, which are created diverse planet, you know, with different species. Well, we're clearing that away so we can have banana trees or whatever, all looking the same and land in a row. So we're doing a lot of bad things. And we also, I think, are responsible for the fact that the Earth is now about 2 degrees warmer than it was, I'll say 150 years ago when we first went into this technological revolution. And we are quickly approaching the tipping point. We are now releasing methane because with the up in the northern, both northern and southern Arctic regions, the further north you go, the quicker the change is occurring. And permafrost is what I was trying to come up with. The permafrosts up in Antarctica, or in the Arctic, I should say, is starting to melt. And it's now releasing methane, which is like 20 or 30 times worse than CO2. And when we get to a point where we can't shut it down, and like the methane is captured down of Gulf of Mexico, for instance, it's frozen in the sense that it's in a more of a solid state, the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, because of the pressure and the temperature of the water. But if that water warms up too much, then that methane may come out and start bubbling up to the surface. And so now we've got all this methane, and it's over. There's nothing we can do about it. It's called the tipping point. And Attenborough said we might witness, not we, my grandkids, maybe, the sixth extinction event on this planet. So I think the aliens are probably knowledgeable about that. They probably might be worried about it. And maybe they're going to try and step in at the last minute, do something, I hope. So that might be one thing they're up to. I know, because people say, well, why don't they land and overtly start chatting with us? And there's a few reasons why they might not. Number one, we're pretty violent species. If I was in a jungle someplace and I saw someone sitting there in the middle of the jungle eating a hand of somebody, I wouldn't want to run up to them and say hi. I would just keep my distance. Because we are, you know, in fact, there was a movie made 1951, I think, called The Day the Earth Stood Still, when a UFO landed by the White House. The first thing that rolls in is tanks and everything with their guns pointed to this thing. That's our mentality. It's humans. So that'd be one reason. The other reason would be, what can we contribute? What can we bring to the table? Nothing. So why would they want to even do that? A third reason would be this came from actually a professor of history, I can't remember his name now. He teaches history at a university, and he's written a couple books, one of which is called The Threat. His name will surface in a minute. But anyway, at the last page of his book, and by the way, the book that he wrote, The Threat, he's dealing with reports of abduction reports.
Is it Dr. David Jacobs?
Exactly. David Jacobs. He's the one. And at the very end of that book, called The Threat, he has this really, really, really down feeling about the whole thing. You know, he is depressed about it. And wouldn't you know, about a week later, I happened to go to a UFO conference, and in the dining room, it was all round tables. I sat at the round table, and right across the table was David. And on my right, sitting next to me, was Bud Hopkins. So I looked over to David. I said, David, why do you have this feeling of remorse in your book? Now, he teaches history. He's a professor of history. And he says, well, history has shown that when a more advanced civilization encounters or works, interacts, let's say, with a less advanced civilization, that the less advanced civilization eventually disappears. And that would be us, by the way. So it would be a bad news for us if they did. The other thing is, some people say, well, they're going to take over and take over the Earth. Well, first of all, I believe diversity is very important in the universe. Diversity of life is important. And I believe that there is a galactic federation out there, probably several of them. I think our galaxy is probably split up into a lot of federations. But the rule of engagement might be, first of all, no direct contact with a developing civilization. And the reason, because we don't want you to influence them, because it's important for diversity that they develop on their own. Just, you can watch them, sit back and watch, but do not interact directly. However, in our case, we're about to destroy our planet, and they might actually interact.
Have you seen a UFO?
Yes, I have. It didn't require me to see one to know that they existed, because I had already written my first book. But I was in Mexico, and what I saw was what most people see, what's called a Foo Fighter. It's an orb. Best estimate is they're 6 feet in diameter, and it's a glowing ball. And I was in Cancun on vacation, and I got up early, like 4 or 5, no, it was 5 o'clock in the morning, and I was on the deck looking out over the Caribbean. All of a sudden, this orb shoots over my head. He's probably 100 feet up, and goes out and zooms up and then curves and goes up behind a cloud. And my first reaction was a shooting star. That lasted about a millisecond. And I said, oh, that's a Foo Fighter. And that's what they are. And that's what most people see, by the way. And my interpretation is that they are very sophisticated drones, that they're monitoring us, and there's nobody inside. They're drones. And in fact, Lynn Kitai, who wrote the Phoenix Lights book, right after Phoenix Lights, not right after, maybe a year or two after, she did some research first and wrote this book. She actually had a picture of three of these orbs that came right up to her balcony. She overlooked the Phoenix. She was a doctor, and she had a place up in the hills. She could see downtown Phoenix. These orbs came right up to her balcony almost. And she related that to being a very strange experience, mentally interacting somehow. And that was either several months or maybe a year before the Phoenix event actually occurred. So when the event really did occur, she was really interested in knowing more. And she did a lot of research, interviewed people and everything. And her book, The Phoenix Lights, is a really interesting book to read. And she created a DVD also. I go on forever. But anyway, I did. Yeah. But it wasn't a requirement for me to believe, but it kind of nailed it down for me.
We've been talking about your book, which is The Science Behind Alien Encounters, and you've also talked about your science fiction books, and they're all on Amazon, aren't they?
They're all Amazon. The best thing is they go to my website, which is www.alienlog.com. They'll find where they can click and get directed right to the proper place in Amazon to get the books. They're available e-books, paper books, and in fact, the two Science Behind books, because that's my science series, the Science Behind. Those two are now also available as a hardcover if you want a hardcover. I'm working on the Science Behind Creation of Our Universe Without a Big Bang. And also, I was toying with the idea of a book about the science behind the amazing mummies of Nazca Peru, because I have a lot of information on that. But the next one out will be the Science Behind Creation of Our Universe Without a Big Bang. And it presents the way the book is structured. It's in three parts. The first book is a history of astronomy up till present time, stopping along the way at points in time where either a person or equipment causes a paradigm shift in our understanding of our universe. And then the second part of the book is discusses the Big Bang hypothesis, how it came about and all the problems with it. And the third part is another alternative approach that's not my own. I didn't create it, but I believe in it, that talks about how the universe came about using the same data that the Big Bang theory has, but it does not violate any science, any laws of physics. It also does not require this mysterious dark energy. And as far as dark matter, you can explain that dark matter does exist, but it's not related to the creation of the universe.
Well, thanks for being on the podcast. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you very much.
That was an interview with Dr. Robert Farrell about his book, The Science Behind Alien Encounters. And my book, titled Aspects of Alien Abduction, is now available on Amazon. You can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended versions of the episodes. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.